Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 37. I'm your host, Michael Shoebridge from Strategic Analysis Australia, and I'm joined by Dr. Marcus Hellyer, head of research here at SAA.
Well, hello, Michael. And I have to say, it's very cold down here in Heard Island. I took my dressing cues from JD Vance, and I don't think I've come quite prepared, but it is absolutely freezing here. But we thought it was important to come. We've been delivered by an RAAF C-130 down here doing a welfare check on the inhabitants of Heard Island after the news of these new tariffs that are being imposed on
I didn't think SAA's ready response force was such a great idea when you proposed it, but at times like this, I'm glad we put it in place.
Mm-hmm.
What disturbs me is the locals are reacting in a very determined way that shows they're not going to take this.
They're not going to take this. I mean, there was a little bit of shock and anger. I mean, they're going, why pick on us? Just because we are very efficient at exporting regurgitated fish heads to the US, is it our fault that the US regurgitated fish head industry has collapsed? Really?
The reaction I've had is they think it's partly because they call themselves emperors, and that's seen as hubristic in America.
Well, but also, no one can challenge the emperor in the White House at the moment.
But there's another theory, many of them, and these are families, it's about their eggs, that the US egg shortage has, that they want a deal. They want the Heard Island penguin colony to offer up eggs free into the US market. Mm. And a number of the parents have said they're not going to do
that. Look, we have already seen off one threat to Australian wildlife from the wombat fondler.
Jones, the wombat influencer. Yep.
Yes, we've seen her off, and I'm sure we'll see off this threat to our penguin eggs. So anyway, so much has happened, Michael. What can I say? So much has happened. I don't know how we're going to fit everything in. We may have to do a three-hour episode. So readers, buckle in for... Well, we're going to keep it down to half an hour and a bit.
Yeah, what we're going to try and do is what's happening in Trump land, which could consume the entire time, but it's not. We're going to make sure that we don't go snowblind with it's all about Trump land. We're going to also look at some of the things that have been happening while we're all sleeping or focused on Trump land. So some stuff about China, which is still doing things.
Remember China?
Yeah.
Remember when China was the big threat to Australia? Seems so long ago.
Yeah, and yet so recent with that research vessel and the PLA warships. And we might also mention NATO and a bit about the unsung central elements of what we call our defence program and budget.
Mm.
We'll cover that. So first, Trump land. So we've had Liberace Day now, or Liberation Day. It turns out there were no exceptions. It turns out that the algorithm used to come up with these supposed reciprocal tariffs.
Very sophisticated tariffs. Analysis there, Michael. Yes.
Was it extremely simple and illogical one?
It was indeed. So people very quickly cracked the code that these tariffs were not generated by some deep analysis of sort of informal trade barriers.
Currency manipulation.
Yeah, all of that kind of stuff. Or, you know, Australia saying you can't import beef because of biosecurity stuff. No, they simply took the size of the trade deficit the US has with a particular country and divided it by the scale of imports the US gets from that company.
Goods imports, not even services.
Not even goods. Services.
Yeah.
Which produced a percentage. And because Trump is so nice, he then halved that percentage because he's nice. And anybody who actually had a trade deficit with the US, such as Australia.
Yep, we buy more stuff from them than we sell.
10%, along with the unfortunate penguins of Heard and McDonald Islands. So very dumb, bizarrely dumb kind of algorithm here. And that's where we've landed. And as you mentioned, no exceptions. So any Australian politician who thinks he can show up in Washington and somehow do a deal with Donald Trump is kidding themselves.
Well, the UK actually tried that. They sent former Blair government minister Mendelsohn and a couple of others to Washington. They did extensive negotiation with people in the Trump administration, and at the end of it, they got nothing. They got the same we got.
They got worse, I think, than we got. Oh, no, are they on the same?
10%. They got 10%.
No, the EU got a bigger number.
Yeah, the EU got 20%. So The EU, China, Vietnam, India all got large additional tariff barriers. And we're hearing from the Treasury Secretary in the US, Bessent. He's urging others not to respond. He wants everyone just to suck this up.
We want to bash you up. Don't even try to defend yourself.
And he's and the administration is also saying, and the first countries to come to us and try to negotiate special deals by giving us stuff we really want, you'll be treated better. So it's like informers, isn't it? The first person to inform on my adversary, I'll reward them. But the history shows that that kind of behaviour ends badly for the first informer.
Well, and it's not working because some of the major, quote, offenders are China, South Korea and Japan. And well done, Donald Trump. It's really hard to get the Japanese and the South Koreans to play nice together and the Japanese and the Chinese to play nice together. Guess what? You've got them all playing nice together.
No, you've also got the EU and China looking at each other differently and saying, we were looking at decoupling. In fact, Europe was in a decoupling moment because of China's support to Russia in the Ukraine war. But now this new enormous risk factor called America has driven in, and it's changing the calculations between the EU and Europe on trade and economics.
It is fundamentally changing calculations globally, and when these sorts of moments occur, there are always second and third order effects, and no one has really been able to think that through because we're all terrible at predicting the future. But this kind of stuff is so stupid. So, for example, let's take Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a poor country, but it's been generating revenue and economic growth by a lot of garment manufacturers. And guess what? They sell them into America and all of the big,
big
box stores,
Costco,
like Walmart, you know, Costco. The average American voter, including a lot of MAGA voters, go and buy cheap garments there. You know what a Bangladeshi garment worker makes, Michael?
Not very much.
In US dollars, $113 a month is the legislated minimum wage in Bangladesh for a garment worker. So $113 a month. So if Donald Trump somehow thinks that putting 37% tariffs on Bangladeshi imports is going to somehow
create a garment industry in America.
Garment industry. Yeah. Those people in America have to be willing to work for $113 times 37% or plus 37%. So $150 a month. I don't think you're going to find a lot of Americans wanting to work for $150 a month, particularly if you're getting rid of all of the illegal immigrants.
Well, it's the same as Vietnam.
It is not going to have the effect you want.
Well, Vietnam, I think, is 46% tariffs. About half of Nike's shoes that are sold in the US are made in Vietnam. So the price of Nike shoes is about to go up.
Well, Nike will go, okay, what's the best way out of this? Do I set up production in the US or do I just eat that 40% tariff? I think they're just going to eat the 40% tariff.
Well,
or look around.
They'll pass on some, but maybe not all. But the point is, the plan I think Trump has, such as it is chemotherapy for the American economy and therefore chemotherapy by proxy for the world economy. And it's this thing about, I'm going to reset the cost structures so that if you want to sell in the American market, you've got to make in the American market. And I'm going to have years of pain because chemotherapy is hard and nasty, but the cure is worth the pain. And remember, he's not accountable at another election. He can't stand again unless he changes the rules. And if he changes the rules, that's a whole different story. So this is his moment to shine.
Well, yeah, I'm not quite so sanguine about that because I think one of the things I think we need to talk about is we are getting a little blinded by tariffs. Meanwhile, back in the US, the march towards autocracy continues. So I do think it's Trump is considering running again. And I do think that Trump thinks he will have established a system by then in which it is impossible for him to lose.
Well, I'm saying he doesn't need to worry about re-election because if he does want to stay in power, he will have changed the rules to make sure he does. So I think we're actually agreeing about that. But my point is he's willing to see a lot of pain inflicted on America because he thinks this is chemotherapy and that's the only way to effect a cure. So the idea that he's going to change course because Wall Street is crashing, if he changes course now, he pretty much shoots both feet off. And yes, he's made radical course corrections before and everyone seems to have forgotten about it. This is a much bigger move than that.
And the fundamental Trump pathology is his narcissism, where he thinks he's not just the smartest person in the room, but the smartest person in the world. And this whole approach to economics, driven by tariffs, has been part and parcel of his conviction that he knows how to solve America's problems for decades. So he's not going to turn away from it.
No. So just before we get into some of the internal American stuff, I think my main view is this big announcement is just the start of things. And I don't mean the start of things with let's watch the bouncing ball of what Trump does. I mean realignments and reactions from others. You know,
correct.
There's been a lot of use in recent use of that word agency, saying people in countries have agency. Well, outside America, there are a bunch of big players. The EU, China, Japan, South Korea, India, the UK. There are these other big players that have their own interests, and already they're looking at their own partnerships and approaches very differently because of the enormous risk factor that is now America.
Yeah.
So and everybody else gets a vote in what
they,
we all
they get
do.
A vote. And so we're talking earlier, Michael, and you mentioned that Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, one of the so-called adults in the room, had gone to Europe to talk to the European NATO partners. And basically they said to him, hang on, how can we talk security when you've just started a trade war with us?
Yeah, they said, look, this agenda we have about defense spending and military capability and the war in Ukraine is really important. But how can we get to this pressing agenda when America has just started a trade war with us?
Now, people have agency, but they have to use it. So far, looking at Australia and looking at the government and our bureaucracy and the mandarins, we don't seem to be exerting any agency here whatsoever. We just seem to be saying, keep your head down. It's still your the fight, flight, or
freeze.
We're still in freeze mode. So.
Well, on Heard Island, that makes sense.
I guess so.
Well, my thought is, with all those realignments and reactions, Australia really can watch what these bigger players are doing and leave them to engage with Trump land around this whole architecture of tariffs and what happens and who does what to whom. So the EU engaging with America, China engaging with America, India engaging with America, Japan, and watch a lot of that play out because we are the Stephen Bradbury of American tariffs in this situation. We got 10%, except for those poor inhabitants of Norfolk Island who got considerably more. And that is as good as it gets. So we really can watch the damage to others and look for opportunities rather than dash madly at the Trump administration with special pleading. I don't think we need to look needy. Maybe we need to think about what do we want from America rather than how can we appease America.
Well, again, I'm a little more sanguine. And so we have this view from some of our politicians that they could get a deal with Trump. So Peter Dutton's going, well, you know, we can build on our defense relationship and get a better deal. Well, I don't think Trump is actually interested too much in deals. The bigger project is this one of completely rebuilding the US economy. So
individual deals is
not part of that, because if somehow Australia comes along and says, well, we've got this great relationship based on 100 years of cooperation and shared blood, all the rest of it, so we get a deal. Well, if Australia can get a deal, then everybody else will think they get a deal. So I don't think Trump is really interested in too much in deals at this point.
The UK has tried this and it's failed badly because there are no special relationships. This is a bigger thing for Trump. This is his moment.
The thing is if you say, well, guess what? We've had this great relationship and you need Pine Gap. You need our geography. So be nicer to us. Give us a deal on tariffs because of Pine Gap. Trump is just as likely to say, what? Hang on. We've got all this stuff in Australia. What are you paying for that? Whoa. It's the price has now gone up. Well, and if you don't pay it, the tariffs go up to 25%.
I think he's likely to say, did you say Pine Gap? we've got all the lumber we need right here in America. We don't need yours. But he's also likely to do what you say. Remember South Korea? He was after a retrospective bill of, I think, $8 billion for the luxury of having American troops on the Korean Peninsula from in his first term. So a retrospective bill for American presence in Australia is probably what the outcome would be of raising something like
Blanket. So I sound like I'm saying we should stick to the freeze strategy. I'm not sure about that, but I'm certainly not saying Australian politicians should campaign somehow thinking that in the next election, somehow thinking that they're going to do a better deal with Donald Trump.
No, I'm not recommending the freeze strategy. I'm recommending not being needy, because being needy with the Trump administration means you get victimized. Mm-hmm. We saw President Zelensky from Ukraine going through that experience. But what I'm saying is, we need to watch the realignments and reactions of the other players, and we need to work with them rather than try to lead some kind of engagement.
And the other thing is while we're, again, getting snowblind looking at tariffs and the international impact, everything Trump does is driven by domestic politics. It is a classic textbook example of the primacy of domestic politics.
Well, which is why these special relationships aren't meaningful, because it's the domestics, stupid, to paraphrase Bill Clinton.
And when we look at domestic politics, that, again, that drive towards autocracy is continuing. And not only are the woke elements of American society being kind of persecuted here, or certainly driven out of government and not getting any government funding, but as we see with the recent Laura Loomer affair, so dyed-in-the-wool MAGA supporter, on and off kind of confidant of Donald Trump.
Big social media presence, driving the MAGA line on every issue.
And it appears that she has recommended to Trump that he purge some members of the national security community, not because they're woke, but because they're, quote, neocons. So in a sense, they're representatives of this, the kind of beltway blob. And their threat is that while they may get the US involved in wars, fighting for American allies overseas.
Well, I think a couple of them, one of them thinks that Taiwan is an important security issue. Another one thinks that supporting Ukraine and not having Russia succeed in its invasion is a good idea. And they both haven't passed Laura Loomer's vetting test. And what an amazing term to associate with a MAGA-driven social media influencer, that she is vetting people on the US National Security Council, and her vetting is being listened to by the US president, who is sacking people based on her assessment.
So if you somehow think you're going to go to Washington and use Pine Gap as a trade good with Trump, you are kidding yourself. So, you know, I am very concerned about the ongoing deliberate march towards autocracy in the US, and as we see from other historical cases, there is this kind of increasing dynamic of radicalization. You need to keep radicalizing to keep your base G'd up and supportive. And yes, I know we're seeing sort of small elements of pushback in various sectors of American society and politics, but at the moment, the radicalization.
I think the project is rolling on, isn't it? The Trump project, and probably Project 2025, it is pushing on faster than people had understood. And that MAGA influence is affecting America's international strategic and military approach as well. And look at how quickly events that are scandals are getting swamped by the continued rollout of announcements, news and attention. So the signal scandal that in any other time would have resulted probably in the resignations, not even the sackings, they would have resigned before they were sacked, of people like the head of the Pentagon, the National Security Advisor and the Director of National Intelligence, who clearly all participated in something that was against pretty much every security policy that the US had.
Yes, except if you're the person who defines American security policy.
Retrospectively, but this point,
though. So you're
though,
Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence. You can shamelessly go in there and say, well, no national security information was shared on Signal. I'm the one who gets to define what is national security information.
So. Well, it's actually Hegseth that gets to define what's US military classified information.
So these are the guys who are somehow meant to police themselves. And they are absolutely shameless. We saw them in their confirmation hearings, where in the whole election campaign, they would say, A, I'm going to do A. And then in their confirmation hearing, they'd be asked by senators, are you going to do A? It's like, no, I'm never going to do A. And then, of course, they're confirmed. And one day later, they are implementing A.
I do think there's a connection between the Laura Loomer vetting thing with National Security Council staff, the Signal scandal around classified information, and the enormous risks that Trump tariffs are bringing to the global economy. And they're all about making America a riskier, less reliable partner. That is the net effect that we're seeing.
Correct. And I think so. And I think part of the freeze strategy is based on this view in the Australian government, but in our national security blob, that it will go away. And all of our defense and security seniors are like, well, my phone is full of all of the phone numbers of important people in the US.
I've spent my entire career years building contacts in Washington.
Yeah, for 25, 30 years, I go to Washington, I know who to talk to, and they love us. We're special partners.
Broad support in Congress, across agencies. Yep.
And it's okay, don't worry. Yep. Well, guess what? All of those numbers on your contacts list are now irrelevant in Washington.
My view of this paralysis in Australian political and national security circles about America is there are two factors at play. The first one is they don't know what to do. This is absolutely unthinkable. It's unprecedented. They really don't know what to do. And so the answer when you don't know what to do is to pretend it isn't happening and hope it all goes away. That's one factor. And the other factor is the personal one. How long am I in this job? My appointment as the secretary of a department like Defense or Home Affairs or as the head of an intelligence agency, that's probably got 2 or 3 years to play out. So if I just keep very still and quiet and keep doing what I was doing before, I can keep telling everybody that the strategic thing is to realize in the long term it's all going to come good. And I can leave the building having not faced this intractable, unthinkable problem, but telling everybody how wise I was.
Well, I think we've mentioned before that one of the hardest things in the world to do is to get a middle-aged white guy to admit they were wrong.
And well, so, I was wrong about that. I've seen a bunch of them do it.
So all the sort of middle-aged white guys and some middle-aged white women who have been essentially providing advice to our government to double down on the alliance because it's all going to work out, and that you don't just want interoperability with the US military, you want interchangeability, yes, which means essentially getting exactly what they have. They sort of must be going, how's that working out? Well, it's not working out so good, but gosh, I don't really want to admit I was wrong, you know, and I haven't got an alternative.
I haven't heard a government minister in Australia or an official talk about the seamless integration of the Australian and US defence industrial base that we've achieved through the export reforms around AUKUS. I haven't heard them talk about that recently.
Are our defence exports now subject to a 10% tariff?
Well, I think you've heard Ireland and Norfolk Island exports are. The answer is yes. So it is seamless. But it's an example, isn't it, of let's pretend nothing's changed, because to admit something's changed is unthinkable and I don't have an answer. That is the Canberra situation.
And I don't want to admit I might have been wrong.
But so, probably that comes to a fore with our defence budget that was released by the government. It seems like ages ago, but it wasn't long ago. I know we're doing an event with Defence Connect on the 16th of April, an election event which will look at the current government's approach to defence and their budget and whatever the opposition has said between now and then. But you've had a look at the budget already.
So I've put a piece up on the SAA website already, doing an initial budget analysis. And as you say, Michael, we're doing a longer publication, which will be launched at the Defence Connect event on the 16th of April and have more detailed budget analysis. So I would encourage our listeners, A, to attend that event, and if they can't attend the event, to get a copy of that, because it will be up and will be freely downloadable. So the defence budget is, I think one would have to say, more of the same. So all of the things we've seen in the world haven't fundamentally changed or even
modified
the defence budget. So if we sort of go back in time, the story so far, 2016 white paper sent out a 10-year funding line.
And an investment plan.
Yep. Governments have basically delivered that money, but they haven't increased the funding. And actually, we're now in year 10 of that 10-year funding line.
Oh, yes.
So what has changed? Well, last year, the government put out its National Defence Strategy, and that had a new funding line. That's where the famous $53 billion number comes from that ministers keep referring to.
Historic increase.
Historic increase. We can argue about that. And then in the first 4 years, the forward estimates was $5.7 billion.
Historic increase.
Historic increase. But a couple of points around that. First one is virtually all of that money was going to the submarine gap, so the cost gap between the cancelled attack class submarines and the new SSN program, with some money for the new general purpose frigate.
Oh, so not actually an increase of spending on anything else,
no,
on a couple of new things.
No, in fact, to make that whole thing work, they had to eject over $70 billion worth of other stuff.
Oh, so
from the plan.
A $50 billion historic increase over 10 years, but with a $70 billion set of cuts.
Yes.
That is historic.
Yes. And the other thing to note about the 5.7 in the forward estimates is there was virtually nothing in the first...
In the early years, yeah.
2 or 3 years. It was all back-end loaded. So what's changed this year? Well, Mr. Miles, Defence Minister.
Isn't he also the... He's the Deputy Prime Minister. He's also the Defence Minister.
Oh, well, okay.
His
well,
big job is the Deputy Prime Minister.
The big job is Deputy Prime Minister, which isn't actually a job. It's not even a real office, but anyway.
There's more pomp and splendour and you get more red carpet and bands. But so that's the big one.
Anyway, the Defence Minister said that in this budget there would be a $10.6 billion increase.
That's historic.
That sounds a lot of, like a lot of money, but it's actually simply repeating the previous year's National Defence Strategy announcement.
Oh, you mean that was already the plan for the budget in the National Defence Strategy?
Yes, it is the existing plan. So as we go through time, that $50 billion that we spoke about kicks in and starts flowing into the back end of the new forward estimates, right?
Yeah.
So I think 5 point something has flown into the new back end of the forward estimates. So the $5.7 billion,
that
the last year's
there,
forward estimates, is now $10.6 billion for this year's forward estimates.
Because you just got that extra year and there was some extra bills for AUKUS and general purpose frigates.
So there's no more new money other than what was announced last year. Now, the government has also said they've brought forward $1 billion. So they've gone, okay, so yes, the money is at the back end, but we're going to bring that forward. So
I've squeezed the toothpaste tube. I've got some from the bottom of the toothpaste tube.
So I'll try and move some of it forward. So they said they've moved $1 billion of it forward, which is kind of correct, but 700 million of it actually has gone into 24-25. So the year that's ending. And you're going, oh, that's good. Are we doing a rapid buy of some? We've got a good deal on missiles somewhere that we're going cheap. No, it's really an accounting measure to cover some bills that they had already.
It's kind of, I got the cash flow wrong.
I got the cash flow wrong, and actually I need to keep my capital program liquid.
Yep.
So I'm going to sort of...
I don't want my accounts qualified, so I've got to bring it forward.
Yeah. I don't want to trade insolvent. So that $700 million is really an accounting measure. So we're sort of still in that same situation we were in a year ago, where the big new money is still sitting a couple of years out into the future. And there's really, since the 2016 white paper, hasn't really been a meaningful change to either the 24-25 budget or the 25-26 budget.
You know, I'm going to look very positively at this. I think it shows, you said people are no good at predicting the future. Well, it turns out in 2016, Australia got everything right about the world and about military technology and about conflict. We got everything right in 2016, except the one thing we didn't get right was how important nuclear submarines would be in 2054. So we corrected that error with the announcement of AUKUS, but everything else that we put in the plan in 2016, except for that $70 billion worth of cuts, was perfect. So I think we should congratulate that government then and every government since for being mature enough to stay with what is obviously a very clever plan. And the fact that our military is getting weaker over the next decade, that was part of the plan.
Well, one of the things we are seeing is, so we heard from the government that when they announced the so-called optimal pathway to nuclear-powered submarines, that it would be $268 to $368 billion over the next 30 years.
To 2054, yeah.
Yeah, and but in the next 10 years, it was going to be around about 53-ish kind of billion.
To get the first one, on the way
well,
to getting
that,
the first
that would get us to the first yeah. submarine. So we're sort of getting more granularity around those numbers, and what we're already seeing is that rapidly expanding blob and the impact it's having on the rest of the force structure. So next year alone, in 25-26, we'll be spending over $3.5 billion on the SSN Enterprise, even right. though we are still, best case, about 7 years from having the first
Virginia submarine. Yeah.
And if you sort of project those numbers out, by 2030-ish, we'll be spending $10 billion a year on the SSN program.
I did see some article from someone who claimed defense expertise saying that actually, look, just settle everybody. It's that same kind of thing about there's nothing to see here, just stick with the plan. The cost of the AUKUS submarines is pretty similar to the cost of the cancelled French submarine program. Now, I don't think that's true, but it's me just thinking that. I think you have put some numbers around that, and it's not true.
It's not true, because whenever you compare two numbers, you have to sort of understand what is underneath those numbers. So it's completely illegitimate, I would say, to compare an SSN number,
yeah.
that goes out to about 2053,
yep.
with a attack-class submarine program that was made public that goes out to 2080.
So the French attack-class submarine program, that costing was a whole-of-life cost. And what was it, roughly?
It was about $235 billion.
But it went out to 2080.
It went to 2080. So it is acquiring the submarines and then getting 30 years of life out of each of those submarines. So a grand total of $235 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to take that AUKUS number of 268 to 368 and compare it, you actually then have to project that out to 2080 as well.
So for another 25 years.
Or in which you're operating the full fleet of submarines. Because that 2053 number, we have only just hit, best case, 8 submarines.
Yep.
Probably only going to be 7. Yep. So you don't have the full operating cost of that fleet, full fleet.
Yeah.
So once you incorporate that in, you are getting up to around about $700 billion. And these are all outturn figures. So taking inflation into account, and as we know, the further you go into the future,
it gets bigger.
It gets bigger.
Yeah.
The analogous figure, I would say, for the SSN program is, and again, we can have high and lows and different, data points and blah, 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 blah. I'd say at least $700 billion. So,
okay, so 230 versus 700.
Yeah, so
they are not the same.
No, three times as much for the SSN fleet. Now, it's a whole separate argument to say, are 8 SSNs providing you three times as much capability as 12 large conventional submarines? You can have that argument.
Yeah.
But first of all, you actually have to have some agreement on the actual cost. And for me, you're looking at about three times as much.
Yeah. And this, to me, surfaces a problem with this defensive AUKUS by people that say, look, of course it's extremely risky. Of course it's very big. Of course it's very hard. There are lots of moving parts, and you can point to whether the US is going to have enough submarines itself and they're not on track to build more, and you can talk about the UK's terrible troubles, but we've just got to have faith. We've just got to believe. And in fact, it costs a lot, but it only costs about the same as the French submarine. All of this is smoke and mirrors. What you really need to do is have a clear-eyed view of what are the risks and challenges and how are they being managed?
Correct.
And you can't manage them if you won't even recognise them.
Well, to me, this quasi-debate, and so I heard it again. So I went to this event on Monday organised by former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to talk about the alliance, to talk about AUKUS, to talk about submarines. And there are a number of defenders of AUKUS and the SSN program. And they sort of had this strange view that, first of all, you've just got to make it happen. You know, there's no such thing as plan Bs for big complex projects. You just commit and you do everything possible to make it happen.
We said we'd do it. We've got to make it happen. Yeah.
And if you even talk about the viability of it, that's somehow undermining the prospects for success. So stop arguing about it. Just get on with it.
You're a quitter or you're a splittist.
So a splitter. But to me, that gets back at one of the key problems I've had for a long time with the way defence manages risk. Now, as one of the speakers said, defence, understands the risk and it comes up with these risk matrices and they're very detailed and they understand what they're doing.
Yep.
Okay, risk matrices are about two things. It's a matrix that has likelihood and consequence.
On the two different axes.
Two different axes.
Yep.
And so there are two elements to risk. It is likelihood of the risk being realized and then the consequence. But people always just default to likelihood. Mm. They somehow think, well, if we can stop the risk happening, things are all going to be good.
Or if I can reduce it. So it's from extreme to almost certain or likely.
But in all of those matrices, if you have a high extreme consequence, even if there's low likelihood, it's still a high risk, right?
And actually, I read about this kind of calculation being made in real life with the two astronauts on the Boeing Starliner docking with the International Space Station. So that the thrusters that controlled that Starliner as it approached the space station failed, and enough of them failed so they only had a single point failure left. One more thruster failed, they couldn't control the spacecraft. They eventually reset them and managed to dock, but their decision about not using the Starliner to return to Earth was because of the consequences of the risk occurring again.
Mm.
It wasn't just the likelihood, it was the consequence, because the consequence was killing the two astronauts.
So even if you do everything you possibly can to reduce the likelihood of the AUKUS program not delivering SSNs or delivering them at such a late point that we've lost our submarine capability as the Collins falls over, even if you do everything you possibly can to reduce that likelihood, because the consequences are severe, extreme, catastrophic, whatever you want to call them, you still have to manage the consequences. And to me, that's why when I talk plan Bs in the submarine space, it's not doing yet another submarine project either instead of or as well as SSNs. It is hedging your risk,
by
hedging
the consequences
different. By doing something different. And that different can range from B-21 bombers, down through a whole bunch of other systems.
Well, to armed long-range underwater vessels.
Yeah, Spear 2s, let's call out the Spear 2. But things that will deliver the effects you want from SSNs through different means. But at the moment, people are just missing the point and saying, if we just double down and do everything we possibly can to make sure SSNs are delivered, that's managing the risk.
Well,
that is
actually
not managing the risk, people.
I think it is worse than that. I think the risk behaviour we see from defence and from the government is, I've put the risk down in a table. I said this was extreme risk.
So I said, there it is.
I've already managed it because it's sitting in my risk register as extreme. And I've told the government that. Everybody knows this is extreme risk, so just let me get on with it. And that's not risk management. That is risk identification. So I think it's even worse than forgetting about consequence.
And I would say the portfolio budget statements that we've just seen are kind of similar to that, in that they're not managing the consequence of the strategic risk we're in. We're sort of going, we'll keep pressing on the way we are. We'll do everything we possibly can to make sure AUKUS is delivered. We'll kind of cross our fingers and hope that the alliance holds up. We are not doing anything to manage the consequence of either AUKUS falling over or the alliance becoming even more wobbly.
And the consequence of the particular defence and budget plan that we have is a weaker Australian Defence Force over this critical 10-year period. And even then, even after that, I'm not sure it strengthens because of the radical changes in the way warfare is conducted and the way supply chains and our economies are going to be working. Now, but I think the last thing is, and this will be relevant to our election campaign and debate here in Australia, is Marco Rubio is in the middle of a NATO meeting, the US Secretary of State, and we mentioned how his NATO partners are saying, well, it'd be good to talk about what we're going to do with the war in Ukraine, good to talk about defence spending and defence capability, but you've just started a trade war. He has presented the new normal for defence spending to American allies. He said, look, it's great people are saying they're on a path to 3%, but actually 5% is the only acceptable defence expenditure from an American ally. So I want to leave this meeting with you, NATO partners. We're reliable, but we're only reliable if you've got a credible near-term plan to get to 5% of your GDP on defence. And here we are in Australia with the government saying I'm at 2%, going to 2.3% 10 years from now.
Yeah.
And the opposition perhaps promising 2.5% in the next term of government.
Well, this it may happen. We haven't heard that. Mr. Dutton hasn't spoken numbers
even
yet.
Even if it does, it's radically out of step of the kind of demands that our major ally is now making.
And at risk of repeating myself, you can see two broad futures. One in which the US remains an ally, remains engaged in the Western Pacific and North Asia. But to do that, the price of its allies is to pay, well, we were saying 3%, maybe it's 5%. Okay, so that's one future. The other future is they become a very unreliable ally. We need to increase defence self-reliance. We need to do more for ourselves for that world in which we can't rely on the US. Well, I would argue that 3% is at least the starting point there of greater self-reliance. So whichever way you look at it, this slow, achingly slow march towards 3.3 over a decade just does not
2.3
cut it. 2.3 does not cut it.
I think we should just end with a quick shout out to Xi Jinping because China still does exist in the world. It's doing more radical military intimidation of Taiwan, sent three warships around Australia. Now this scientific research vessel that's been celebrated by New Zealand scientists. Peter Jennings wrote a great article on our site on that.
It seems to be taking the long way home past HMAS Stirling, our major naval base. Coincidence? Don't know.
May want to reassure the penguins on Heard Island, so we might be able to see it here from our vantage. But the other thing that Xi Jinping is still doing is purging the Chinese military and the People's Armed Police. The People's Armed Police is bigger than the Chinese military. It's got a huge budget because they do all the internal security, all the home repression.
Which is a higher priority for the CCP.
He's purged the general at the top of that, who was a very close aide and an appointee of Xi himself. He's disappeared along with more PLA senior officers. So it's back to your point about autocrats. Too much control is barely enough. And the problem when you keep purging even your closest supporters is suddenly you can't trust anybody and you're stoking a subterranean opposition. So as we think about China on this inexorable path because of Xi Jinping, I think we've got to realize he's putting some very dangerous seeds in place that could threaten his own control. Anyway, we better get off this island now. I'm seeing some penguins approaching us. One of them thought I was American. So I think it's time to get back in the SAA rib and get out to where at the Australian Anzac frigate is waiting to take us home.
There's an Anzac frigate out here.
Okay. Well, actually, it's a New Zealand one. But anyway, it'll take us home.
Okay.
Great to talk with you, Marcus.
Thank you, Michael.